Hello, this is Chris Long with the sixth episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Agent Joan Pulma, whose aunt he believes has been murdered and is investigating the murder, and the giant man that is involved with the white slave trade seems to be trying to check them out on his own, have now met. In fact, the giant man did help Agent Pulma in beating up some fellows. So this is becoming more interesting. There's a lot going on in paradise. Chapter 38. The trip to Elgin Air Force Base took about 30 minutes. The duffel was where it was supposed to be, and Pulma signed the necessary paperwork, loaded it into his rental, and drove back to paradise. Along the way, he passed through Destin and eyed Landry's high-rise. That made him remember he needed a new place to stay. He arrived back in paradise around noon. He hadn't missed it for even a minute. He made a stop at Bailey's funeral home, where he needed to see his aunt's body again. After he was finished there, he drove directly to his aunt's house. The sun was high, the day was hot, and the humidity had crept so high that simply walking produced rivulets of sweat. But Pulma had spent many years of his life in heat even worse than this, and it had little effect on him. He entered his aunt's house using the key that the lawyer Mason had given him. Now that he had his duffel, he could make a proper investigation. He unpacked his duffel and spent the next 5 hours going over the interior room by room. The only remarkable thing he found was nothing. The only fingerprints were his aunt's. That was why he had stopped by the funeral home, to take a set of elimination prints from Betsy Simon. There was no sign of forced entry, no indication of a struggle. He found a box of photo albums stuffed in a closet next to the small laundry room. He looked through a few of them and stuck the box in his duffel. He would look at them later. He moved his investigation out to the backyard, where he followed his aunt's presumed path from the house to the fountain area. He got down on his knees and examined the stones around. The disturbed stones under the water, the holes in the lawn made from the walker. If his aunt's body had still been here, he might have seen something that was not right, but it wasn't, and thus he couldn't. He sensed someone watching him and turned and saw Cookie peering over the fence. "Did you grow?" Pulma asked. "I'm standing on a box. What are you doing?" asked Cookie. "Just satisfying my curiosity. You really think she was murdered, don't you? What do you think?" "I don't have an opinion. I thought it was an accident, but I wouldn't know what to look for." "Well, I do know what to look for, and I'm not finding much. Did you speak to Mason?" Pulma rose and went over to the fence. On the box, Cookie and he were close to eye to eye. "I did. He was helpful. What do you know about him?" "Like I said, good lawyer. He's handling my estate, too. He does the same for lots of people." "You know him beyond that?" "Some, but we're not really friends, socially." "Did you hear about the bodies washing up on the beach?" "The Storrows. I knew them. Nice people. I wonder what the hell happened." "The police are checking it out. The paper wasn't very full of details. Do you know anything?" "If I did, I wouldn't be at liberty to say." "Are you working with the police?" "No, I tend to work solo, but I'm just naturally tight-lipped with details like that. Still gives me the creeps thinking of her dying there. I guess I need to arrange for the funeral service and all. Betsy told me that she wanted to be cremated. It should be in her will." "Mason didn't mention that. Did he give you a copy of the will?" "Yes. You should read it. Betsy was very particular about her funeral arrangements. I'm sure she spelled them out to the letter." "Thanks. I guess I should have already done that." "You're young. You don't think about wills and funeral arrangements." "I'm also a soldier. We tend to think about them more than most people." Pulma left Cookie, went back inside, and packed up his equipment. He took one last look around and hauled his duffel out to the Tahoe. He sat in the driver's seat and pulled out his aunt's last will and testament. After skimming over most of the legalese, including the part leaving the house to him, he arrived at the provisions about her final arrangements. Betsy Simon did indeed want to be cremated. She had pre-funded the service with Bailey's funeral home. That included an urn for the ashes and a request that they be spread over the Pennsylvania countryside where she had grown up. He tucked the will back into his pocket. He would speak with Bailey's about this. He figured they were probably very experienced with cremating folks down here. He was starving, and he had no place to stay. He would take care of the food first, the lodgings next. He also had to check in at the police department. He figured Landry would soon require his sworn allegations to process the 8 idiots who had come after him last night. He checked his phone and was surprised that there was no text from her, or Bullock. He wondered if the moron Hooper had stopped puking yet, and then he stopped wondering about Hooper. He put the keys in the ignition, pulled his M11, and hit the gas, pointing the Tahoe straight at the car. Sometimes the direct way was the best. Chapter 39. Pulis slid the nose of his Tahoe to within an inch of the passenger door of the other car. The man seated there stared at him in surprise. The driver was trying to back up the car. Puller eased the nose forward until his hood was touching the car's passenger door. If the driver backed up any more, he was going to seriously damage his vehicle. Puller watched both men for any sudden movements. He raised his gun into view, rolled his window down, and motioned the passenger to do the same. "What the hell are you doing?" "Not what I wanted to hear," replied Puller as he climbed out of the Tahoe and came around to stand next to the car. The M11 held at an angle that would allow him to shoot at his target within a millisecond and not miss. "What I wanted to hear was why you've been tailing me, and I would follow that up by asking who the hell you are." All three men turned their heads when they heard the screech of tires, followed by the whoop of a siren. A police cruiser had turned down the street and was advancing on them. Puller saw the driver first, and his heart sank. It was Hooper. Next to him was Landry. Hooper looked excited. Landry seemed uncertain. Puller slipped his M11 back into its belt holster as the two cops got out of their car. Hooper had his gun pulled. "Of course you do," thought Puller. Landry kept her gun holstered, but placed her hand on top of its butt. Hooper advanced, swiveling his gun back and forth until he finally kept it pointed at Puller. "You just can't keep out of trouble, Buckaroo. I wasn't aware I was in trouble." Hooper looked at the proximity of the Tahoe to the other car and said, "So you always park this close to other vehicles? If I want to have a private conversation with somebody, yeah." This comment made Landry snort and Hooper scowl. "You keep up with the bullshit, your ass will be in the lockup so fast you'll get a nosebleed," he snapped. Puller said nothing to this inane comment because there was really nothing to say. Even the guys in the car looked like they wanted to laugh and probably would have it, except Hooper was now pointing his gun at them. Puller said to Landry, "Can you ask your partner to holster? His finger is past the trigger guard. To me, that means you're going to fire." "Hoop," said Landry in an admonishing tone, "no more accidents, okay?" "More accidents?" thought Hooper Puller. "You know he's armed," said Hooper, indicating Puller. "I am armed because I'm required to be by the United States government," pointed out Puller. "You can take it up with the Pentagon if you want, but I think federal trumps state, at least in this instance." He pointed at the two men in the car. "By now they might be armed, too. I don't know for sure." Landry's gaze flicked to the car's occupants. She stepped forward, her hands still gripping the butt of her sidearm. "Will you gentlemen please step out of the car with your hands where we can see them?" "I can't open my door," said the guy on the passenger side. "His truck is blocking it." "Then slide across and out the driver's side," said Landry sharply. With Hooper keeping his aim on them and now ignoring Puller, the two men slid out of the car, their hands held out in front of them. "Are you armed?" Each man looked at the other. "We are not armed." "Open your jackets." The men did so, and there was nothing to see except shirts and belts. "Why have you been following me?" Puller said. The driver looked at him. He was about 6 feet tall, broad shoulders, tapering to a slim, hard waist. His companion was likewise built. Their buzz cuts matched, too. Up close, they looked even more military. "Who says we've been following you?" "I do," Puller said. "This is the fourth time I've seen you, twice on this street. It's a small town. Let us see some ID." The men pulled out their wallets and handed over driver's license. Landry wrote down the info in her notebook, while Puller tried but failed to see the names and addresses on the licenses. She handed them back. The first man said, "Unless you have some reason for holding us, I'm assuming we can go now." Landry glanced at Puller and then back at the man and said, "Can you tell me what you're doing in Paradise?" "Just down here on vacation." "Have you been following this gentleman?" "No, I'm thinking about buying a place on this street, actually. Even contacted a realtor about it. This is her name and contact info. She'll vouch for me. We were sitting here going over what places we were going to check out when this guy came flying at us. Seems to me that instead of questioning us, you should be arresting him. I thought he was going to ram us with his truck." Landry glanced down at the card and then frowned as she glanced once more at Puller. Puller could read all the doubts in that look. "Thank you for your cooperation. I'm sorry for any inconvenience," Hooper said. "Do you want to press charges against him?" He indicated Puller. The man eyed Puller as though trying to absorb every detail of his face. "Nah, he doesn't seem worth the trouble." He smiled at Puller while his friend let out a snort of laughter. "So just move your truck and we'll be on our way." He drew closer to Puller. "But you try something like that again, it won't be as accommodating." Landry stepped between them. Perhaps she had caught the look from Puller that indicated he was about to millisecond from breaking the man in half. "That's enough of that," she said, pushing them apart. "Puller, move your vehicle. Now, gentlemen, you have a good day." Puller climbed into his truck and backed it up just enough to allow the other car to creep past. Then the driver accelerated, turned the corner, and was gone. Puller got back out of the truck. "What were their names?" "That is none of your damn business," snapped Hooper. Puller looked at Landry, inquiring. "It is none of your business, Puller, and just be glad he didn't press charges. Now from here on, just stay away from them." "Me staying away from him isn't the problem. They're following me." "So you say, doesn't make it true," barked Hooper. Landry said, "Puller, their story does sound logical. If they're looking for a house on this street, and I see three for sale signs..." Puller knew this was both. The guys had their cover story, but Diego had seen them near the Sierra. He didn't think there was any real estate in that area that would interest the two men, but he kept that to himself. "Okay. You're probably right." Landry clearly didn't believe him, and Hooper clearly still wanted to arrest him. He turned to climb back into the Tahoe. Hooper said, "How do you know we're done with you yet?" Puller turned and stared at him expectantly. "Okay, are you done with me?" Hooper looked surprised by the question and glanced at Landry. She said, "Hoop, finish the patrol on this street. I want to have a word with Mr. Puller." Hooper climbed into the cruiser and hit the rack lights and engaged the crowd control button. The blasting noise caught Landry completely off guard. "Damn it, Hoop, just go," she snapped. He sped off faster than he should have on a residential street. "How do you stand working with that idiot? What is going on with you? Come on again. Are you getting paranoid?" "I'm not paranoid. Those guys are following me." "You have proof of that? I'll get it." "What you need to get, Paula, is to just leave it alone. Those guys didn't look like the types to be messed with." "And you think I do?" "I know I need to come down to the station and press charges against the guys from last night." "You might not want to do that." "Why not?" "They want to press charges against you." "Come again? They said you attacked them." "I did, before they attacked me." "You might not want to go around admitting that." "They were in my room waiting to ambush me. Little hard to spin that. They've already been released on their own recognizance." "Things work that fast in Paradise? I don't know what to tell you. I was told those guys didn't have gang connections, but someone is apparently pulling strings behind the scene. I'm just a beat cop, Puller. I don't get into stuff like that." "So they're out on the street waiting to come after me again." "I don't think you have to worry about that." "Why?" "Because I told them you were a super special forces homicidal maniac who could kill them in more ways than they could even imagine. I told them that the next time you would kill all of them and then get your army buddies to come down here and help kill their families for good measure." Puller cracked a smile. "You actually told them that?" "That was the gist of it, and for the Latinos, I said it all in Spanish so they would get the point without having to translate. I said if they left you alone, I could guarantee their safety. Otherwise, all bets were off. They all looked scared to death when they left, and I really don't think they're going to press charges. They're too afraid of you. Okay, I appreciate the assist. You're welcome. Now you can focus on what happened to your aunt. I wish every local cop I work with was as cooperative with you. You treat me with respect, I reciprocate. The moment you stop doing that, so do I. I've got no problem with that, he paused, wondering whether he should even venture there. But it would be a good way to ask more questions, and he found he was enjoying Landry's company. She could be a good asset for him on this case if it turned out his aunt's death wasn't an accident. You free for dinner? She looked surprised, and Puller thought a bit pleased by the invitation. You let me stay at your place rent-free. I'd like to do something for you. She thought about this for a few seconds. Proud of Puller thought she was going to say no. I get off duty in 2 hours. Where do you want to go? Your town. I'll defer to you. There's a place called Darby's on the main drag. Okay, I've seen it. Say about 8 o'clock? Sounds good. He climbed into his truck and drove off, but he was no longer thinking about dinner with Landry. Tweedledum and Tweedledee in the sedan. He needed to know who they were and whether they were connected just to him somehow or to what had happened to his aunt. And maybe he had a way to do that. He picked up his phone. Chapter 40. Well, well, I was wondering when the hell I was going to hear from you. Just been a little busy, General Carson, said Puller. General Carson, I thought we had moved to Julie. I'm still working hours. It's still working hours, ma'am. Wasn't sure you felt how you felt about that. Julie Carson was a one-star stationed at the Pentagon in the J-2's office. The J-2 was a two-star who gave the chairman of the Joint Chiefs the daily briefing. Carson was the vice chair and gave the briefing when the J-2 was unavailable. She had helped Puller during his time in West Virginia. She was 41, very attractive, as fit as a triathlete, and as tough as Puller. They had a rocky start, but things had turned around after they'd found some common ground. What I feel is that you can call me Julie. Okay, I need a favor, Julie. What? No dinner first? It's always a question of timing. He heard her sigh. Okay, what do you need? Puller briefly outlined his dilemma to her in succinct military crisp sentences that gave her the minimum amount she needed to follow along. The habit was so ingrained in him that he didn't even realize he was doing it. Damn, Puller, I heard you were out on R&R. What the hell are you doing in Florida in the middle of something else? Do you plan to work your way across all 50 states getting into murder and mayhem? Believe me, this is not by choice. If my aunt weren't involved, I wouldn't be down here. I'm sorry for your loss, she said quickly. So you think it's foul play? It's looking more like it, though I don't have a shred of proof. And the two guys in the car, you really think they're military? We are, were or are, I need to find out which. I can run the plate for you today, but it might just be a rental. It probably is, but if so, they had to put some name down for it and show a driver's license. That might give us enough to go on. I'll get to work on it ASAP. I appreciate it, Julie. Now that's what I like to hear. How are things at J2? Actually, I'm fairly bored with the routine. Thinking of a transfer? The rest of my military career will be a series of transfers, the choices of which will largely be dictated by other people. That's how it goes when you're chasing more stars. Yeah, I got a taste of that with my dad. Probably one reason I opted for the enlisted side. Too much thinking goes on with the stars and bars side of thing. You're an enlisted and enlightened man, Puller. She paused, and when she spoke next, Puller heard a subtle change in her voice, like she was going from Pentagon mode to something more human. So what are your long-range plans? He said, finish up down here and get my butt back to Quantico. I'm sure CID will find things for me to do. I'm sure they will. Military crime never takes a holiday, Puller. Not when you have hundreds of thousands of mostly young men around the world trying to all act macho. Add to that billions of dollars of taxpayer money flying around and things get complicated. Hands go into cookie jars and around other people's throats. So you see yourself being a military cop all the way. I haven't thought that far down the road, quite frankly. You really need to start doing that. You're not getting any younger. For a second, Pola thought she was going to say, "We're not getting any younger." Sound advice. Okay, if you take it, I'll call you as soon as I know anything on the plate. In the meantime, try not to get killed down there. I'm just starting to like you. I'll do my best. So you said your aunt left you the house? What the lawyer told me. A house in paradise? Guess so. I might have to come down and check it out. Why's that? Hell, isn't it obvious? I've never been to paradise before. I'd like to see it if it lives up to its billing. Well, it hasn't so far. Pola clicked off and pondered what to do next. He looked at his watch. Now that he didn't have to go down to the police station and press charges, he had a little free time before his dinner with Landry. He had some items on his to-do list. Check out the lawyer, Griffin Mason. Check on Diego and his cousins. Duplicate the 10-mile there and back trip his aunt might have taken. He made up his mind quickly. Check on Diego and his cousins, just in case. Chapter 41. He is gone. Pola stood in the doorway of Diego's small apartment and looked down at Isabel. Little Mateo was behind her, his thumb stuck in his mouth. Is that unusual? Him not being here, it seemed to me that he spent a lot of time on the streets. He comes back for lunch, but he did not. He always comes by 6, but he did not, said Isabel. Do you have a phone? She shook her head. When did he leave? This morning. I worked late at the restaurant with my grandmother. Diego was looking after Mateo. He left before I got up. My grandmother did not hear him leave either. I am very worried. Did he say last night what he might be doing today? He usually goes down to the beach. He sells things to the tourists. Sometimes he works for the hotels. He's too young for that, isn't he? She looked at him like he was crazy. Okay, I'll keep an eye out for him. Pola looked at the bruises both had received from the Gang of Three. Have any of these punks come around here, Isabel? I have seen none of them. I hear that you beat them up again, and their friends. Who did you hear that from? I just hear it. I'm going to get you a disposable phone and leave you my contact info. That way you can reach me and I can get in touch with you, okay? She nodded. It took Pola about half an hour, but he dropped the phone off and then climbed into his Tahoe and drove off. As much as he didn't like it, Diego would have to wait. He hoped the boy was okay, but something was telling him that wasn't the case. 20 minutes later, he pulled onto the street where Griffin Mason had his law office. The same Infinity was in the driveway, yet he didn't pull into Mason's driveway. He spotted another little house down the street with a sign out front and pulled in there. He got out and knocked on the door. An attractive blonde-haired woman in her 40s answered the door. She was short and curvy, wearing a short black skirt, black hose, and a matching jacket. Her white blouse was open enough at the top to show a slice of cleavage from her ample bosom. Since it was still about 90 degrees outside, Pola assumed that in all that black plus stocking, she was probably sweating just by being at the door. Can I help you? My name is John Pola. I was out here yesterday meeting with Griffin Mason over an estate issue. He's not my lawyer. He represented my aunt, who recently passed away. He said to check references before I decided to keep him on with the estate work. Griff gave me as a reference? That's right, Miss Doughty. You seem surprised. Pola had gotten her name from the sign outside that he had her picture, and also helpfully included the fact that she was fluent in Spanish. That's because I am, and I don't really have time to talk. She started to close the door, but Pola held out his army creds. I came down here yesterday from D.C. My aunt died unexpectedly. I don't know a soul in town. I'm just trying to come up to speed fast and doing my proper due diligence, the military way. Any help you can give me would be appreciated. My son's in the Navy. Navy's given me a ride many a time. He stared at her expectantly. She glanced down the street toward Mason's office. I've got a dinner meeting to go to in about 20 minutes, but I can answer questions for you until then. Come on in. A minute later, they were seated in her office, which was far neater than Mason's. "So as I explained, Miss Daddy, just make it Sheila," she said. She pulled out a cigarette. "Don't worry, it's an electronic one. Damn thing really works. Smoked for 20 years, then went cold turkey. Then with this a year ago, hope my lungs can regenerate." Paula watched as water vapor rose from the device and then refocused on her. "As I said, Sheila, I'm just checking references on Mason. I assume you know him." "Oh, I know Griff, all right. So would you recommend him? I'm a lawyer. I say anything negative, then somebody can sue me, and Griff certainly would." "Well, that in itself is sort of a negative answer, but nothing actionable." "So you wouldn't recommend him?" She sat back. "Who was your aunt?" "Betsy Simon. Didn't know her, but if she was Griff, had Griff handling her estate, it's probably most cost-efficient to let him keep going. But a piece of advice, watch the financial accounts like a hawk." "Is that sometimes a problem with Mason?" "I wouldn't use the word sometimes." "Then why would people use him?" "He must hide his tracks well." "But you must know differently." "How?" "Let me put it this way. I've been practicing law down here pretty much as long as he has. Our client list is very similar. We handle the same sorts of cases. Trust and estate lawyers are not like the Wall Street M&A guys. We don't get rich doing this. I sure as hell haven't, and I work my ass off, excuse the language. But Mason has gotten rich. Don't let the crummy office in the old house fool you. I live in East Paradise, 2 blocks off the water, because that's all I can afford. I drive an 8-year-old Toyota Camry. Mason has a 1-acre waterfront spread that is definitely well into the 7-figure range. In addition to that, infinity, he drives a Porsche and an Aston Martin. And he takes trips all over the world, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, South America. Doesn't take a genius. The clients are not footing all that, at least not knowingly. So he's stealing client funds. Again, how come no one has wised up to it? You can't be the only one who's become suspicious because of the house and cars. You have to prove it. You have to want to prove it. And apparently no one has. His clients are old, and then they're dead. The heirs usually are out of town. I see it because I live here, and I'm in the same profession. Anything else? She tapped her cigarette on the desk. You didn't hear it from me, but besides the money, there's also something else going on with that guy that gives me the creeps. What's that? He seems to like children. He seems to like children way too much, if you know what I mean. Why do you think that? I was with him at a legal function one time. After it was over, he got drunk as a skunk in the hotel bar. I was just about to leave when he pulled me back to the table. I thought he wanted to rent a room and get a quickie on with me, as if I'd even consider something like that with him. So he's tried to come on to you before? Let's put it this way. He always tries to look down my shirt and feel up my ass any chance he gets. But then he started showing me all these pictures in his wallet. She paused and pursed her lips in disgust. They were all of young boys and girls. Did he explain why he had them? He said they were his kids. He laughed. He must have been drunk out of his mind. Probably doesn't even remember showing them to me. Are you sure they weren't his kids? She smiled and took a puff on her cigarette. Well, considering the fact that he's a fair-haired Irishman and the kids in the photos were black and Asian, no, I'm pretty sure they weren't related. Chapter 42. Another hot day on the job had left his fellow workers soaked in sweat and craving cold beers found among air-conditioned bars. Mako left them to their bottles and returned to his room. He did not interact with them at work and did not care to be with them while they were away from work. They seemed fine with that. It would not have mattered to him if they had not been fine with that. He was not sure what the altercation had been about next door the night before, and he really didn't care. He had, however, seen the other man fight. He was good, excellent, in fact, but he had allowed himself to be outflanked. He would have died if Mako had not helped him, and maybe I should have let him die. This was not a flippant thought on Mako's part. The other man did not belong here, and people who did not belong somewhere usually had a good reason for being where they didn't belong. The man had had a gun, a Sig P-228, but it had been slightly altered. He could tell that even from the distance and in poor light. the other man's fitness, close-shaven hair, close-quarter combat skill, and the weapons were telling. He was military, American military, judging by how he had spoken to Mako last night. There were many military bases around here, which prompted the question of why the military man was staying in a place like the Sierra, and what had he done to anger the street punks? Maybe nothing. Mako had done nothing to aggravate the ones who had come after him that night on the streets. They were like hyenas looking for prey in all the right places, and occasionally running into someone who fought back. Then the hyenas would run away. They always did. As he sat on his bed, he forgot about Puller and reflected on the additional information gathered on the Lambert estate today. After his brief conversation with Chrissy Murdoch, he had continued to work the grounds. Over near a stand of trees, he had seen one of the maids talking with a pool man. He had drifted over and listened. When the maid was done with her conversation, Mako had edged still closer to her. When she saw him, she looked startled, but he spoke to her in Spanish, and his smile was disarming. As he worked along, he spoke with her. Her reticence diminished. Her answers grew longer. Her name was Beatriz. She was very beautiful. Her skin was light brown and smooth. Her hair was dark and luxurious and smelled of coconuts. It was clear that she took good care of her hair. She had not worked much outdoors, he could tell from the condition of her skin and the smoothness of her hands. She was from El Salvador, she told him. She had been working here for 2 years. She looked healthy and well-fed. Her uniform was spotless. She had not survived on one of the boats. She had not arrived on one of the boats. At least he didn't think so, but he couldn't be sure. He asked her in Spanish about her coming here. Then he had his answer. She looked away and hurried off. He wondered if she knew what her name represented in Spanish. Voyager. She had not come very far geographically. She had traveled the equivalent of a trip to the moon, he knew. But now she lived in the big house and wore the spotless uniform and had enough to eat. Back in her native country, he doubted this had been the case. So she should be happy, only he knew she wasn't. One could not be happy when one was a slave. No matter how well you were treated, you were still a slave. He had knelt down and started collecting twigs and scraps of leaves. The Lamberts, he had been told, demanded a perfect lawn, with every blemish needing to be removed. They paid well for this. They probably spent more on landscaping services in a week than most people would earn in a year. And perhaps Lambert wanted no blemishes on his fancy lawn to compensate for the ugly wounds he inflicted on others. Or perhaps he was not that complicated a man and gave no thought to this issue. Mako rose and put the debris in a trash bag he had carried with him. He knew that security had been watching him more closely, but apparently talking to a mere maid for a bit did not amount to an actionable offense, as it had with one of the ladies of the manor. He felt a presence nearby and turned to see Chrissy Murdoch come out of the main house and the man who had been with her in the Maserati. The man had on a seersucker suit, white shirt, and a red bow tie with loafers and no socks. He looked like an ad in one of those magazines where everyone looked perfect and led perfect lives. Is your life perfect, sir? Would you like a little imperfection in it? Would you like me to take your smug, perfect face and rip it in half? Chrissy had on a long, flowing white cotton dress with a scalloped front. The harsh light made it pretty much transparent, allowing Mako a long, titillating look at her legs. A wide-brim hat protected her from the blazing sun. Her slender, tanned feet were encased in sandals that showed off her pink toenails. Chrissy spotted him and actually waved. Mako looked around to see if there was anyone else she could be possibly waving at, but there was no one. The man did not take note of this. He was apparently lost in his own little world, to such a degree that he was unaware this woman was being screwed by Peter J. Lambert. Mako began to grow suspicious now. It was not natural that someone like her would pay attention to someone like him. There had to be another reason. He did not wave back, but instead returned to his work. They drove off in the Maserati, and Miko wondered if Chrissy had showered to remove the scent of sex of Peter J. Lambert from her body. Maybe she didn't care. Maybe her man didn't care. Life was perfect, after all. He had walked through the front gate and busied himself in the bushes, positioning himself where no one could see. He had snapped some pictures of the gate and surveillance apparatus with his cell phone. He was confident that he could find in the dark the exact positioning of the power and data transmission line. He had better be able to. And then the long day had finally ended, and now here he was in his room. As he sat on his bed, he thought back to Chrissy Murdoch. Something was definitely off there, but he couldn't put his finger on it. He would have to reflect on it some more. There were many things that could go wrong, and some would, but there were certain things he could keep from going wrong. Chrissy Murdoch might be one of them. He lay back on his bed in the sweltering heat. It didn't bother him. He had trained his mind to ignore such physical discomforts, and when the mind did not pay attention to such things, neither did the body. The mind controlled pain, and the pain could make pain go away. He had survived much agony with that simple philosophy. Tonight would be busy. He had two things to do. The first surely would be problematic, the second catastrophic, but he had come here to take risks, not to avoid them. Chapter 43. Cheryl Landry was not in a uniform. She wore light blue capri pants, a yellow sleeveless blouse, and white sandals. Her hair, unconstrained by a police cap, went down around her shoulders. Poole arose from the table at Darby's as she approached. He had taken a shower at a local YMCA for a daily fee and changed into fresh clothes, khaki pants, short-sleeve shirt, and loafers. As she sat down, she looked, he thought, a little self-conscious, as though she preferred the uniform and clunky shoes to what she had on. The waitress brought menus, and Poole glanced over his, while also checking out the folks at the other tables. She caught him doing this, scoping the place. Always good to have alternative exits just in case. One behind the bar, another left of the kitchen. I take it you like scoping, too. Comes in handy. What's good on here? He asked, indicating the menu. Scallop, swordfish, mussels, and the New York strip, if you're into cows. They ordered drinks in their meals. Poole had opted for the swordfish over the cow. They sat back, and Landry finally seemed to focus on him. Something you want to say? I don't know, should there be? We could run that one in circles for days. You invited me to dinner, not the other way around. Fair enough. But you do make people nervous, Poole. I've been told that before. I'm sure you have. Eight guys beaten up, nearly ramming another car, doing your own investigation, and we found out you get a set of elimination prints from your aunt's body. The chief was not happy about that. No law against me visiting my aunt's remains, but there is a law against obstructing a police investigation. I was under the impression that you weren't conducting one, so that what exactly am I obstructing? It's not that simple, and you know it. I do? Their drinks and appetizers came, and they both plunged into them, perhaps as a way to avoid more conversation, at least until it became absolutely necessary. They didn't return to the tropic until their entrees were nearly done. Landry took a sip of her Riesling and glanced at him. Ready to resume the War of the Roses, he asked. Oh, I haven't started to fight. I think we should be on the same side, a house-divided thing, you know. I'm in one kind of uniform, you're in another. Not that much difference, really. Look, I'm not saying that your aunt wasn't murdered, and I'm not necessarily saying that she was. That's why people investigate. So I'm really not seeing the problem. You come here to do your thing, and let's say you find out she was killed. Okay, then what do? Find the killer. Wrong. That's for the police to do. That's my job. So you want me to do all the grunt work and then hand off the arrest to you? I don't need you to help me look good, she said heatedly. Never said you did. So where does that leave you? I don't know. You could work with me. She glanced sharply at him. I usually work solo, so it's a remarkable offer. Shows I have great confidence in you. And exactly how would that work? I do it in my off time, the little I have of it. Yeah, And then what? We crack the case and shove my boss's face in it? How does that advance my career in law enforcement? I'm not saying it does. And if that's your only goal, then your answer to my offer should be no. What other goal should I have? Bringing to justice somebody who killed an old lady. He leaned forward, his look growing as dark as he suddenly felt right now. I hope that might be why you put on the badge in the first place. Don't read me the riot act. I don't deserve that. 20 seconds I would have agreed with you. Do you really want to go down that road? I can make your life miserable. I think the police department has already done a good job of that. Yeah, well, I'm a lot more subtle than Hooper. I'm not looking to make enemies, Cheryl. I'm just trying to find out the truth. If this had happened to your family, I have to believe you wouldn't just walk away. The comment seemed to pierce whatever wall Landry had built up during this exchange. She looked away and then down. All the classic signs of capitulation. Puller knew from interviewing so many suspects. She said, I get how you're feeling, I really do. Okay, then I guess it's just a matter of where we go from here. But just to be upfront, I'm going to keep looking into this. It's just now it's just how I'm built. He paused, searching Landry's face for her reaction to this. When she said nothing, he continued, if I find something substantial, I will bring it to you. Then we can determine what to do from there. Does that seem workable? What do you define as substantial? If it's a suspect or a body, I think that might be too late. I will work really hard to keep you in the loop the whole way. How about that? How about if I work with you on my own time? Is that what you want? I think so, yeah. It's what you originally suggested, isn't it? I guess so. I just never really expected you to bite on it. So why are you? I don't like people dying when they don't have to. Then I think we have a deal. As they were leaving the restaurant, Pola's phone buzzed. It was a text from General Carson. She had run down the plate. When Pola saw the information, his eyes widened. This case had just gone to a whole new level. Chapter 44. You want to come back to my place and talk about this some more? Landry asked as they walked out of Darby's. Pola wasn't paying attention to her. He was staring down at the phone in his hand. More specifically, he was staring at the text on his phone screen. I'm sorry if I'm boring you, Landry said crossly as she eyed the device in his hand. He put it away in his pocket. Sorry, something just came up. What were you saying? My place, talk some more. We could walk on the beach. It's up to you. No skin of my nose if you decline, just trying to be friendly and keeping you off the streets and out of trouble. Pola thought about this. He still didn't have a place to stay, but he didn't think it was a good idea to crash at Landry's place again. And even though he had finished processing his aunt's home, he still didn't feel comfortable staying there. She had left it to him. Of course, so he had every right to be there if he wanted, but what it really came down to was that until he figured out what had happened to her, Pola didn't think he deserved to stay in the woman's house, not after all those years of not contacting her, letting her tumble from his life like an insignificant piece of debris. You know of any places I can bed down in paradise? He paused and smiled. If you think it's safe enough for me, why not stay at your aunt's? Those guys in the Chryslers are tailing me. It would be too easy for them to keep tabs on me. You really think they're following you? Don't know one way or another. Until I do, I'm not taking chances. There's a place called the Gull Coast. It's on Gulfstream Avenue, 2 blocks south of the Sierra. It's a little bit more money because it's closer to the beach, but you probably won't have to worry about being murdered while you're brushing your teeth. Sounds right up my alley, thanks. So you want to hook up later? I usually take a walk on the beach at night around my condo building. I'll meet you there in an hour. That'll give me time to check into the Gull Coast. Okay, see you in an hour. She walked to her car and pulled it to his. He punched in the numbers on the phone as he pulled out of the parking lot. Wonder what took you so long, said Carson on the other end of the phone. I figured you'd call me the second after you got my text. Just got a little backed up down here. But tell me something, how can the Pentagon be told to stand down for running a lousy license plate? We did trace it, you know, to a big cloud somewhere over the Indian Ocean. Not really, but it might as well have been. Total dead end. I was as surprised as you. Figured it would turn out to be a private company. Then we got the call to knock it off. Call from who? The official source apparently did not wish to identify itself to a lowly one-star. I got the word from higher up the chain of command. So, are you in trouble? I don't think so, but I might be wrong about that. I had a friend at USACIL trying to run the plate for me. I got called by Colonel Walmsley. He tried to shame me into coming back and cleaning the mess up, but then he figured out who my father was and backed off. I wonder if he got warned off, too. I don't know about that, but we sure did, and J2 is not used to having its hand slapped, I can tell you that. Who has the horsepower to do that? It's not a long list, but the higher-ups want to keep secret. They do keep secret, right or wrong. As a soldier, I get that. As a taxpayer, I'm a little more aggravated. So be aggravated. It is what it is. The two guys, anyone's guess, what do they look like? They look like me, only smaller. So former military, like you said on our last call. I don't know for sure, General. General, we're back on the clock. Okay, she said in an amused tone. Maybe they're still on our side. In fact, since you got called off, maybe they are on our side. Maybe, but it prompts the question of what the hell you've gotten yourself into, Paula. Blowback from West Virginia? That's what I was thinking. It touched a lot of very hot wires. It looked like things turned out great, and you were the hero. But you know, D.C., things could have changed. Maybe they're looking for a scapegoat. For a reason unknown to either of us, wouldn't be the first time something like that has happened. Meaning me as the scapegoat, and I was involved too, if you recall. So why would they be down here tracking me? He gripped the phone so hard he felt the shell begin to cave in. Puller, I'll call you back. What is it? I'll call you back. Puller clicked off and hit a hard right because the Chrysler guys kept showing up where he was. He had simply assumed that they had to be after him. They had to be an assumption he had no business making. While it was true that the guys had been taking up a tail on him, they had been seen around the Sierra after all. They had to have picked him up from some point, and he knew what that point might have been, my aunt's house. But they might not have been following him. They might have nothing to do with blowback from what happened in West Virginia. They might have been checking out Betsy Simon's home, and it wasn't a huge stretch to their having killed her. He didn't care if they were from the Pentagon or if someone high up was trying to call the dogs off. If they had killed his aunt, they were going to pay for it. He punched the gas and the Tahoe sped off into the darkness. Chapter 45. Puller parked two blocks over and walked the rest of the way to his aunt's home. He did it by a very circuitous route. If people who could call off the Pentagon were involved in this, then Puller had to raise the level of his game accordingly. He stopped near a fence line and studied the terrain ahead. It was 10 o'clock, dark even on the Emerald Coast, where the sun purportedly never stopped shining. It was quiet on Orion Street. A slight cooling breeze was blowing in from off the water. A car started up somewhere, its ignition shattering the silence. Puller hunkered down and took cover behind a bush to remove himself from the philosophy of headlights reflecting possibility of headlights reflecting off him. The car drove past. It wasn't the sedan with the two men inside, but Puller still recognized it. It was Jane Ryan driving past in her blue Ford Fiesta, the dent in the side door looming large in the wash of streetlights. What the hell was she doing here? She had already gotten her things from her aunt's house. There was no way he could follow her. The Fiesta was nearly out of sight as it turned the corner. By the time he hustled back to his vehicle, he took up the chase. She would be long gone. He slipped out into the open and continued down the sidewalk, his gaze moving like radar. He reached his aunt's house and opted for entry through the rear door. The lights in Cookie's house next door were on. Apparently the retired baker was in for the night, or perhaps he had not yet gone out. As he was walking through his aunt's backyard, Puller heard a little yap. He trotted to the fence and peered over. Sadie looked up at him and yapped again. Puller eyed the dog and then glanced over at Cookie's house. Then he eyed the dog again. What had Cookie said to him? He knew the Staros, the couple found dead on the beach. They were friends. He was stunned by their deaths, just like he had been stunned by his friend Betsy's death. There was nothing surprising there. There was one unanswered question. Had Betsy Simon known the Staros? He looked down at Sadie barking. The little dog seemed sad and lonely, and if it was possible, her little features seemed confused. Cookie said he would usually let Sadie out late in the morning to do her business. Pulla had seen multiple leashes hanging on a hook by the back door when he had visited the house previously, and he had seen Cookie walking Sadie. But Florida had snakes and gators and other types of nocturnal predators. Why let your little dog out alone at night, even in a fenced backyard? Pulla jumped the fence and landed near Sadie, who jumped back in surprise and started yapping again. Pulla scooped the little dog up in one arm and pulled his M1 with his right hand. Sadie, perhaps sensing that something was amiss, stopped yapping. Her tongue gently licked Pulla's arm. Pulla kept his gaze on the house. He reached the back steps and slipped quietly up them. The door was unlocked. He passed through, checking out all possible ambush angles before venturing far in. He cleared one room after another, keeping low and to the side, and giving limited opportunity for anyone hiding inside to get a clean shot at him. His search ended in the upstairs bathroom. He put Sadie down, and the little dog started licking at the water. Pulla put his gun away and stared down at Cookie. He was naked and in the bathtub. More precisely, he was resting at the bottom of the tub. Pulla made no move to pull him out and attempt to resuscitate him. It would have been for naught. The eyes stared up at Pulla, the eyes of a dead man. Drowning, he was certain, would be the official cause of death, just like his aunt next door. Folks found submerged in water usually died because water was in their lungs where water should not be. The question then became, how did the person become submerged? Three possible scenarios presented themselves. Cookie could have some medical crisis, a heart attack, a stroke, a seizure, or a drug reaction that had rendered him unconscious. He then would have slipped under the water and died, or he could have hit his head, knocked himself out, and gone under. Or someone could have held him under the water. Pulla did not think the fourth possibility, suicide, was realistic. The body had its own emergency reaction to attempted suicide by drowning. It fought for air. You could kill yourself out in the ocean by drowning because you gave yourself no opportunity to get back to land, but not in a bathtub. Pulla spotted the bottles of medication on the sink next to the tub. He didn't touch any of them, but did read the labels. Blood pressure pills, fluid retention capsules, arthritis, vascular, beta blockers, pills presumably to counteract the interaction of other medications. The bottles went on and on. Welcome to being old in America, the land of the blissfully overly medicated. Pulla looked around once more, taking in tiny details that might have great significance. Seeing nothing else, he decided he had intruded enough of what was now no longer a suburban residence but a potential crime scene. He pulled out his phone and hit 911. It was shaping up to be a long night. Chapter 46. The long night did not start off well. The police cruiser skidded to a stop at the curb with its rack lights turning and its siren blaring, crews crushing the quiet of the night. Officer Hooper climbed out and pulled his gun as soon as Pulla stepped clear of the house. The other cop with him was a man who looked similar enough in appearance to be Hooper's brother. He had his gun out, too. "I can't freaking believe this," said Hooper. "Landry's off duty. Why are you still working?" "None of your business," snapped Hooper. He returned to his partner. "Boyd, this is the jerk-off I was telling you about. Body's in the upstairs bathroom. If you screwed with the crime scene, you are in serious trouble." "Hope," said Boyd. "Who's to say he's not our guy?" "I called it in," said Puller. "I waited here for you to arrive. Why would I do that if I'm the guy?" Hooper said condescendingly, "Well, that way we wouldn't suspect you. You army guys, all that stupid, and the motive? Not our problem, that's your problem. Actually, our criminal justice system adheres to the innocent and proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt philosophy, so it is your problem." Another cruiser pulled up with an ambulance in tow. Chief Bullock climbed out. He was dressed in civilian clothes, so Puller assumed he'd gotten a call at home. He walked straight past Hooper and Boyd and up to Puller. "What do we got? Dead man in the bath. No sign of a struggle. Could be he had a medical crisis and went unconscious. Post will tell us a lot more. I saw a car driving away from here a few minutes before I found the body. Blue Ford Fiesta with a big dent in the passenger door. Know who was in it? Woman named Jane Ryan. She was a caregiver to my aunt, and she knew the deceased as well. I don't know if she was coming from this house or not. If so, she has a lot of explaining to do. Hooper and Boyd just stood there open-mouthed as Bullock and Puller talked. Finally, Bullock looked over and said, "Hey, Hoop, what the hell are you waiting for? Secure the damn area. We have a potential crime scene here. You too, Boyd." Hooper and Boyd holstered their guns and hurried to do this. Some days, I don't know why I bother with the likes of those people constituting my police force. You've got Landry. If I had all Landry's, you'd never hear me complain one second. If this turns out to be a homicide, that'll be four in just a few days. I don't like that. Way out of proportion to the population down here. Scare the tourists away. Town council won't like it. Any leads on the Storrow's murders? Not a one. No one saw anything. No one heard anything. But they were murdered, no doubt of that. Cookie, the man in the tub, knew the Storrow's. How the hell do you know that? He told me so. That's a link. Yes, it is. My tech will be here any minute. In the meantime, I better go see for myself. You better. He started off. Puller didn't move. You coming? In a minute. Got something to check first. Bullock went into the house, and Puller hustled to his truck, passing by first Hooper and then Boyd as they were stringing up yellow police tape. Both cops gave him dirty looks, which he ignored. He popped the rear door on the Tahoe and dug through his duffel. He found the photos he'd taken from his aunt's house. He rifled quickly through them. It took him all of 2 minutes before he found it. He held it up, letting the interior trunk light fall fully on the photo. In the picture was his aunt and Mr. and Mrs. Storrow bracketing her. He recognized their faces from the newspaper story that morning. Apparently, like Cookie, she'd been friends with them too, and now they were all dead. He looked at Cookie's house and then at his aunt's house. If this kept up, there might not be anyone left on Orion Street. This concludes the sixth episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Your reader has been Chris Long.